They were adamant that they were going to create a new society, a better society, a society free of corruption.
I guess maybe for some people the great question about America is the Superman question.
What I want is somebody that can lay out some plans to trap these guys and whip hell out of them, kill some of them. That's what I want to do. I'll try and bring something back for me instead of just give up.
Chile, the Chilean army made a coup. The United States government was surprised by the coup.
But what happens if Superman turns evil?
Extent is just being very powerful. That is something you are, not something you choose to be.
The United States of America, far from the fires of war, had seen none of the devastation that its allies had experienced in Europe.
America is very powerful because of its a country of continental scale with the most dynamic, biggest economy in the world. That is the basis of it. Choice comes in, really, in the 20th century. The Americans almost choose not to be a superpower in 1919 to 20. They choose to be a superpower in 1944 to 1947. And in that sense, yes, they chose.
Furthermore, America was booming. Weapon sales to the Allied forces had provided work and jobs, making the United States the number one economy in the world. The question is, what prompted the United States to put aside its proud isolationism and claim a decisive role in the world events which shaped the second half of the 20th century?
You could say it was World War I and World War II, which themselves were essential to the rise of the United States, to the reorganization of the world, so it was no longer Great Britain that was the world number one imperial power. But it was the United States, and such changes in the structure of world power can only be achieved through war.
Really, the core of empire is power, you know, it seems to me. And, you know, America became very powerful because it became a society of continental scale. In one sense, that's the simplest answer.
In fact, they were supplying both sides in both conflicts. Henry Ford was supplying military equipment to Hitler as late as 1941.
I think the American elites are very conscious of the fact that power is shifting across the Atlantic towards them.
So the key thing then was, what kind of world system should there be, economically speaking, in which there would be jobs for up to 60 million American workers?
People often talk about the Marshall Plan, which occurred immediately after World War II, and that was when the United States lent or gave billions of dollars to Europe so that Europe would have the money it needed to purchase the products of US factories. So US industry was given a huge boost by World War II, by war production. After World War II, it continued to supply huge amounts of manufactured goods to Europe, and the United States lent Europe the money that it needed to buy these manufactured goods, and that was what the Marshall Plan was all about.
Well, the Marshall Plan was very much the product, the very intelligent product, of a society which had a lot of spare resources, was immensely rich, which had a vested interest in rebuilding Western Europe, but this was certainly a policy of very intelligent self-interest.
What American liberals wanted after the war was a clean slate to reconstruct the world, and clearly after the war there's going to be even more expanded. And what were all those soldiers and workers going to do?
But this wasn't new news. It was an age-old scenario about to play itself out all over again.
When you have a system in which you have nation-states, nation-states will compete for power. And the nation-state that is the most powerful will get the most attention. And this has occurred for centuries. You can argue that for a while the Soviet Union was there to rival it and so on, but really it becomes clear from the 50s and the 60s that to really use that overused phrase, if America sneezes, the rest of the world catches cold.
It was then that the Reds came in.
There is certainly an element in which the United States was hugely concerned that if communism did spread, this would close up its economic potential, particularly in terms of exports. But it was also ideological as well.
And of course, one of the stranger things in the 20th century during the Cold War is that it was confronting another superpower, the other superpower, which also, in a sense, was rooted in the same ideology.
When Stalin reneged on his commitments that he'd made during the war about allowing democracy and self-determination in Europe, the whole variety of actions by the Soviet Union that actually made the Americans think twice about who they were dealing with and therefore the nature of the role they needed to play in the war thereafter.
I think it is in their own perception, and I think probably to some extent, well, I think in reality as well, they fought or were prepared to fight wars abroad. I mean, NATO was, in a sense, a willing wars abroad in order to stop themselves being shut out of the international economy. After all, if the communists had taken over in Europe.
The long-suffering peoples of colonised countries were attracted by the concept of economic justice put forward by the communists. The spread of communism in the post-war world, especially in poor, exploited countries such as those in Southeast Asia and Latin America, paved the way for the United States to become the most powerful nation in the world.
When they saw unrest in Burma or in Kenya or in other parts of the world or in Indonesia, because of their view of communism, the fact that communism was a very different ideology, you know, against private property, that was very dangerous, there was this paranoia. Is that communism? Is it the communists coming again?
Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976. And that period was a period which saw Mozambique being lost to the Western camp and going towards the Soviets. Angola going towards the Soviets. You had Nicaragua and the Sandinistas throwing out to Somoza, who's a dictator. You had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
They needed to go into these countries because the colonial system was under threat. People wanted their freedom. People were breaking out. They were saying, look, this was decolonization. They were saying, we want to have democracy now. Make count. Was this kind of just, was this really believed that this was that the Soviet Union was a threat, or was it deliberately constructed? And I think it's a combination of both. You know, and all these other policies were justified according to communism, and they were saying that basically that the Soviet Union had no intention whatsoever of invading Western Europe or anything. And even George Kennan, who was State Department policy planner shortly after the Second World War, he was the guy who was the architect of the containment policy against the Soviet Union. He himself subsequently admitted that really the fear of the Soviet Union was really a construct of our imagination. This wasn't real.
One of the most effective methods used by US policymakers was support for some of the most vicious dictators that the 20th century had ever seen. Those leaders who would stop at nothing to suppress popular movements towards national independence. US democracy at home had little to do with their support for dictatorships abroad.
Now, the spectre of communism gave them a very, very convenient way of justifying why they had to go into these societies and subvert democracy and facilitate the emergence of local elites who were friendly to their interests in the name of setting up democracy.
Well, I just have to, first of all, seriously question whether they are sincere in their beliefs for democracy. I sometimes ask people, how many military dictatorships must the United States support and help put into power before we question whether they're in favour of democracy.
And we had 70-odd interventions, you know, from just after this, from 1945 to 1990 alone. So that's excluding everything we had afterwards, where they devastated societies in order to essentially prevent people from taking control of their own lives.
I think you can never separate democracy and business. People would like to, you know, we are democracy, political freedom, and we don't have to worry about these messy things about profits and unemployed. Never happens. Not just in America, but in any country.
There, what is the degree to which the arms companies were keen that the American military was well stocked with equipment? And indeed, this was one of the motivations behind one, but only a very small motivation behind the NATO alliance. The American military were initially very concerned, saying, we don't want to take on a commitment to defend Europe. We can't do it very well. And then the arms lobbyists said to them, well, if you realise that if you actually give them your current equipment, you can buy a whole lot of new equipment. And therefore, the American military changed their minds and were happy to see their old equipment, which they had in service, be transferred to European powers.
And this has to be a moral one. We're spreading democracy, or we're protecting our security, you know. These are the things that people can sympathise with. But this is where we get difficult, because spreading democracy, again, people kind of intuitively know you can't really just impose democracy just like that. It doesn't always work.
Fortunately, a number of American institutions already had a successful track record of talking people into accepting their ways. These were the foreign policy think tanks.
And the think tanks were vital to that. So they established courses in international relations for ordinary people, also in the universities, all kinds of luncheon meetings, luncheon groups, which would spread the message, newspapers, magazines, and also lobbying congressional opinion and that kind of thing. So the think tanks, if you like, operated as advisors to the state. They mobilised academics, over 100 academics in the universities, particularly the Ivy League universities, to study American national interests in all kinds of areas. So the think tanks were very important in that way.
The fear took effect immediately.
But what actually frightened people more than anything was what the government did. It was a great help to us because they published something called Protect and Survive. It was a pamphlet, a little pamphlet, 30 pages, and it told you what to do if there was a nuclear war.
We were told there was a daily threat from the USSR. They were about to invade Europe and bomb us with nuclear weapons, and we had to be prepared against it.
And so people began to think, nuclear deterrence? It's not safe after all. If it was safe, they wouldn't give this pamphlet out. So it's not safe, we could have a nuclear war, and they'd tell us to hide under the stairs for 14 days. Ridiculous. So I think that really got people frightened and angry as well.
It was always a nonsense, a dangerous nonsense, cost an awful lot of money, and created a kind of security state.
We had it during the whole time of the Soviet Union here. We were told all the time the Red Army was coming here.
This was not simple paranoia. A man like Curtis LeMay truly believed that nuclear war was the only way to protect his country.
After the war, Curtis LeMay became the head of the newly created Strategic Air Command, created after the end of the Second World War, as the means by which the enemies of the United States would suffer nuclear and later thermonuclear attack. And Curtis LeMay made Strategic Air Command into a very, very effective force. The Strategic Air Command with the motto, peace is our profession. So, ultimate paradox, this enormous striking power of nuclear and thermonuclear bombs, but in order to maintain peace with the Soviet Union.
LeMay wasn't accustomed to leaving things to fate. He had drawn up a detailed scenario for his personal vision of Armageddon, a scenario which became known as mutually assured destruction.
Curtis LeMay's force had mounted two grand tours of the Soviet Union, which they might have done. They could probably have destroyed something like 250 million people. They could have destroyed the Soviet Union as an entity. And they would have had to have sent in explorers to see what the situation was afterwards. In this scenario that I saw, the Americans lost something like 2 or 3 million people. They lost Washington, but that was about it. A war in which a major metropolitan area had been destroyed by one thermonuclear bomb would have been by far the worst war in American history.
The fear effect wasn't limited to the deployment of missile arsenals. Its destructive potential extended into areas not previously anticipated.
Well, the problem in the US, officially, legally, it does have a free, probably the freest press in the world, but there's an awful lot of self-censorship. There are so many boundaries in the mainstream press in terms of what it's acceptable to say and what it's not. And I think this is really defined by patriotism. It is considered in the US to be unpatriotic to criticize the government excessively, especially at a time of war.
One of the most prominent, actually, and the most disturbing, which has been confirmed now by declassified documents, is during the Cold War itself. And we know, for example, that the Soviet Union, the threat was exaggerated. They knew that it wasn't as big. So, you know, there was this problem of, you know, how to justify what we're doing. Soviet Union makes it very convenient. There's a communist threat. Now, the interesting thing is that there was this operation in Italy, and it's Operation Gladio. These networks started carrying out terrorist attacks against Western European civilians and blaming them on leftist communist parties and saying that these were being carried out by the communists.
When the fear effect reached its peak, patriotism and militarism came together in a potent combination which paved the way for involvement in some of the most terrible crimes of the 20th century. It was the bitterest period of the Cold War.
When we are smart enough and brave enough to dare to assert our interests when it comes to election time, despite all of the propaganda machinery which they are able to control, even then it doesn't count. They will find a different way of removing the popular will.
In 1969, and I've been involved with aspects of Chilean life ever since, before even the Popular Unity government was elected. And after the coup in 1973, Pinochet then murdered 7,000 people.
Well, the problem was that for the Americans, the coming to power of the party in Chile was something extremely dangerous, because they saw this as possibility of a new way in which very leftist parties would actually come to power.
Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, then promoted the coup against Allende, in which Pinochet became the president of Chile. It didn't stop in Chile. There was a thing called Operation Condor, which was a US-inspired campaign against the left in Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, Bolivia, and Peru. And 25,000 people died or disappeared during that Operation Condor.
And the Middle East and Iran is no stranger to this. In fact, 1953, the military coup which overthrew the democratically elected government of the Iranian people, the Mossadegh regime, and installed the military dictatorship of the Shah.
In Iran, for example, they justified everything by the Tudeh Party. Their intelligence files showed them that there was nothing going on. The Tudeh Party was marginal, very little likelihood of actually having a huge contingency in Iranian society, but it was justified on that basis.
They nationalized Britain's energy resources, tried to punish Iran for the crime of nationalizing its energy resources under the Mossadegh regime.
There are many examples of where the US has sought to undermine legitimately elected governments. 1954, the government of Arbenz in Guatemala. Later, the way they treated the Sandinistas. Currently, the way they're treating the elected Venezuelan government.
The number of times in which the United States has threatened to use nuclear weapons against unarmed third world countries. Threatened to use nuclear weapons against the Soviet Union in 1946. Then on several further occasions in time of Vietnam, time of Korea, there were many other sort of, explicit or implicit threats to use nuclear weapons. What happened then was, in El Salvador, for instance, you had death squads that were killing literally thousands of people. These were being carried out by units of the Salvadoran armed forces that were trained directly by the United States. I would say also in relation to Vietnam that the US public, it took a long time before the US public turned against the war. The Vietnamese people had to suffer 2 or 3 million people.
The United States' inability to see the world other than through the lens of the Cold War would come back to haunt her years later. Among the United States' Cold War alliances, one of the least significant would result in one of America's worst nightmares.
They knew they were creating a monster. Now, what the official story tells us is that 1989, they stopped financing Osama bin Laden because they had kicked the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan. There was no connection. But this isn't true. This is fundamentally flawed.
One of the most interesting things, of course, in all of this is that the Americans today capture people and say that you were supporting Mujahideen and so forth. Well, it's important for everybody to know that the history of the Mujahideen is intertwined not just with America, but also with Saudi Arabia, with Egypt, with Pakistan, with Britain.
Even the radicalized ideology was financed by the Americans. The Pakistani madrasas and even the textbooks that were used, there were a number of textbooks that were distributed for children, and these were financed by the CIA. And these textbooks had, for example, were teaching children how to count. And the images that they used were images of tanks, guns, bullets. So as you count how many, there were, five tanks, count the tanks, count the missiles. So that was the kind of, that was how heavily involved they were in radicalizing the society.
It's interesting to know that in June 2001, the Americans sent $43 million to the Taliban under Colin Powell, under Colin Powell's direction, to help them with, quote-unquote, the eradication of drugs.
Iran is the new bogeyman. They're very worried about Iran. They're talking, there's the whole issue of nuclear. They're financing Al-Qaeda groups across the Middle East to counter the Shia. And this is absolutely well documented now. It's like giving a knife to the murderer. When you know the murderer is going to go and kill someone, and you want him to kill a particular person, and but he's going to probably kill a couple of other people as well, but you still give him the knife, you are still responsible for aiding and abetting all of those murders.
The Mujahideen units were bought and trained in the mountains of Snowdonia, where I take my children for holidays. They were trained in the highlands of Scotland, and they were taught to use what is known as the blowpipe anti-aircraft missile.
Certainly America's the most powerful actor in the scenario, but let's ask about other scenarios. Who was it that provided the resources that allowed someone like Osama bin Laden to build up his political as well as his economic base? What no one ever thought about was, okay, you defeat the Soviet Union, what do you do next? So nobody ever sat down and thought about it. They all walk away. When the Taliban came in, and I know the point that you're making, is the question of how power was being seen in the region. But let me give you just something that I talk about with students. Power, it's like a kaleidoscope. You turn it and the pattern can change a bit. It's not like someone has power, exerts power, and then that's just what happens. If you exercise power, you turn a whole number of things. So the United States exercising power turned the kaleidoscope, and a number of countries didn't just simply say, oh, that's it. They then responded in different ways.